Hi, my name is Jim Paydar. I'm a retired Chicago Police homicide detective. My son and I wrote a book on beingacop.com, and you can order it on the blog or as an ebook. And I'd like you to listen to ganglandwire.com for some more interesting stories.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome to the Gangland Wire. We're here in the beautiful Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we have a special treat as part of our ongoing series, The Media and the Mob. We have the well-known, world-famous, all-seen, all-knowing man of the streets. Some people know him as Bulldog Drummond, John Drummond, on the phone with us out of Chicago, Illinois. And he has reported on the outfit. He knows more about the outfit than the outfit knows about the outfit. John, welcome. It's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Well, this is Bulldog Drummond, better known as John Drummond, and we're listening, of course, to Gangland Wire today, and thanks for the good intro. It makes, I might sign you up as an agent when you talk that big to me. All right.
Well, you know, we have to be nice to our guest. You know, and John, here we got I want to say a quick thank you to one of your fellow Chicagoites or Chicagoans, Ben Ellickson, who likes to listen to the podcast while he drives his big rig. And he was so excited that we were going to have you on the show. He was highly complimentary. He's been a loyal fan and follower and a reader of yours all the way back. He said, you know, that's kind of where I got that John Drummond knows more about the outfit than the outfit knows about the outfit. And John, you won't believe this, but he sent us a Chicago flag. So we've got a four red star Chicago City flag hanging here in the studio. So we got a lot of fans.
And our friend driving the truck, I appreciate that. That's nice to know. Usually my followers, we meet in a phone booth. There's usually not that many anymore.
Not at a...
Nice, so there's a few of them.
Maybe a coffee shop?
A coffee shop or a bar out on the street corner in a hurried conversation in a parking lot in a car. Oh, those are sources that you're meeting out there. I bet you got a few of those sources.
Well, we did. Of course, now times have changed. The outfit, of course, in Chicago is not like it used to be. It's like the old gray mare.
John, let's talk a little bit about your history. I was reading up about you. You're quite impressive. You got two master's degree, one in social or political science and journalism.
That's basically, actually, I got the only one. I did not quite finish to get my master's at Medill, but I did study graduate. I was a graduate student at Northwestern University, and I do have an MA in political science. That's
okay.
Correct.
The University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
That's correct. From Minnesota. I'm a gopher. That's right.
Yeah, which potentially your nickname could have been John Drummond the Gopher.
Well, I'm glad it's not. Well, that's how I started working. I was a gopher, but they never called me that, though, I'll tell you.
Bulldog's a lot cooler.
Yeah, it sounds a lot tougher.
A lot tougher. You're like these mob guys. You need to have a tough nickname. You know, we had like Tuffy DeLuna here in Kansas City.
Well, I'm sure that they must have had a nickname for you, even though maybe you didn't know what it was, whether it was Bulldog or something else. Or maybe you did know.
That I don't know. Of course, a lot of the names of the outfit guys here in Chicago, a lot of them have been geared by the media, but most of them most of these guys, the handle is their own handle. The only one different would have been Tony Accardo, who, of course, was the boss of the Chicago organization for many, many years, and he's probably the top organized crime figure, I think, in the country. They call him the Big Tuna because he was Joe Batters to what his friends call it, but the media called him the Big Tuna because he always had a cane. He loved to go tuna fishing down in Bimini, and he had a cane on that little cane was the head of a fish. Supposedly was a tuna. They had, you know, it looked like a tuna. But most, a lot of times the media made up, but like Joe Ayupa was called the Doves.
Yeah.
Because he was succeeded a Carter Rudy as a top dog. And he was, of course, you know about him in Kansas City. But what happened to him, he was arrested in Kansas, so I recall, by some game wardens there with shooting too many doves out of season. Or he passed, in other words, he had too many doves, and they call him the Doves because he got arrested on shooting all those doves. So those nicknames have some weird backgrounds to some of them.
Really?
Yeah, the origins from Frontenac,
Kansas. They all
Kansas.
Got them. Just about everybody's got a nickname. That's correct. You're right on that.
That's for sure. Yeah, that you know, where he shot those doves, I went through that little town on a motorcycle trip this summer, and the place where he had them all dressed out was owned by some of his compadres, his paisans that live down there, and it's still owned by the same family, and it's still down there.
If I
open.
Recall, that incident happened, when, I think, in 1966 or somewhere about
it. Yeah, it was. I think I was still in high school maybe when that happened. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, their specialty is dressing doves.
Oh. Yeah, by the way, that, as I pointed out, in the air at that time, that did not mean his. At that time, you recall when that name became circulating, that the Vietnam War was on, and his views were not dovish as far as war. It was built. that was not why they called him the Doves. It was because of what happened in Kansas.
Yeah,
not
really.
Because he was a dove in the Vietnam War. It had nothing to do with that.
He probably did not like that nickname. No self-respecting
guy
would like that.
Mr. Ayupa, let me just interject. One of the best nicknames I've ever heard, a funny one, I thought, was actually not here, but in Minneapolis, where I lived at one time. There was a guy named Isidore Rosenfeld with his name, and he got a nickname of Kid Can. And the reason he got that nickname was because every time, supposedly, the police were after him when he was younger, he'd go into a men's room, to a restroom, to hide. And he got the nickname of Kid Can.
Kid Can. Yeah. That is a good one.
Well, Joey Doves didn't have a cane with a dove on the handle, did he?
No, he did not. No, although he actually had some health issues, but he never had anything like that. But,
Well, John, let's talk a little bit about your kind of early career. How did you get started covering the crime beat, I guess? You started out...
Well, I think really before that, before I even was a reporter, I'm going back a ways now to 1950. I was living in Milwaukee, and at that time, the Kefauver Committee was looking into crime and mob rule in the major cities of the United States. Senator Estes Kefauver, who was a Democrat from Tennessee, who wore the coonskins cap, and he was trying to do something politically so he could become president. So he got the bright idea, apparently, or somebody gave him the bright idea, to hold hearings in the largest cities in the United States, like New York, Chicago, Vegas, etc., had large organized crime families. And he became quite well known in New York when they had a guy named Frank Costello, with the Prime Minister of the Underworld. He was on TV. They were carrying these actually live on television, probably the first time they ever did that. This is 1950 and 51. And I recall in Milwaukee walking by an appliance store and where they had TV sets for sale, and people were standing in front of the window looking in. I wonder what was going on, and they're all watching the TV screen, watching the magic lantern, as we called it then, and there you saw Frank Costello's hands, which is the only thing they would shoot. The Prime Minister of the Underworld didn't want his face taken, so they're shooting his hands, and that was sort of a gimmick. And that caught on like wildfire. My interest then was really fueled by that, by organized crime, and that sort of etched my interest in it, the Kefauver crime hearings. And by the way, there was nothing new from veteran crime reporters told me that he exposed, but to the average person, they didn't realize how big the tentacles of organized crime were, and they found it fascinating. All these stories going to these cities that Joe Blow is a member of the outfit, or your neighbor went met him in a hitman, and so on and so forth. So that kindled that, and also had a lot to do with, I think, interest nationwide about the mob. There's no question about that.
Oh, no question about it. Here in Kansas City, it exposed their connections to the local politics and
well, I remember they had to, right at that time, if you're going back a ways, there was two men that were killed, and Bonaggio, and who was the other guy?
Gargatta, Charlie Bonaggio. Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargatta, the two Charlies. That's the main
reason
they've never,
cleared that, to my knowledge. But no. That was going on about that time. I think that was around 1950 when that happened.
It was.
I remember that story.
Just before the Kefauver hearings, I thought.
That's the main reason they came to Kansas City, was because of that, and the notoriety out of that. They may not have come to Kansas City except for that. And they, I've read some of those transcripts, and they're pretty revealing. I was kind of surprised how much they talked about their wire. They had the wire rooms back then, and their horse racing
Sure, that was operation. Big horse racing. It was a big deal then. It's all over the country. There's no denying that. But I got to tell you, that actually, television, the media, the newspapers always played up the outfit very much, or the crime syndicate, or mafia, call it what you will, depending on where you lived. And they realized that's something you could market. And they had a lot of guys with some major newspapers where basically their job was to cover organized crime. Well, they specialized, had other things, but basically their emphasis was on the outfit here in Chicago. In television, we didn't do much of that. I came to Chicago. I worked first at a radio station called WIND, which had an excellent news operation, by the way. And then I went over to Channel 2, WBBM, which is owned and operated by CBS. And I noticed we weren't doing much on that. And nobody was doing much on television or trials or anything until 1969, when you had the Conspiracy 7 trial. That was a trial made famous around the globe for people that being arrested who were involved in some in disorders in the 1968 Democratic Convention. And the TV said, geez, how do we cover that? We haven't done that. So they started utilizing artists, and they realized they could take pictures coming in on the building, and that began to fly. And when that niche was made, in other words, I said, hey, I think I'm missing the boat. And I mentioned a couple of organized crime trials that were going on at the next year, and I showed it could be done. And that certainly was a niche there, and people started I'm talking about in art, in the electronic media, realize there's a market for it. Television can cover trials, and television can even make it better when we do stories like these brackets, who's the crew chief or whoever runs this, the north side, who runs the south side, and so on and so forth. And we used to do those charts and things like that, and we got, I hate to say it, very good numbers. And that's the name of the business, is getting good numbers. I mean, getting good audiences, and that's what the advertisers want, of course. Started here about 1970, and I remember the first trial I covered, a Juice Loan trial, and then one was Jackie Cerrone was in, and a guy by the name of Joe Ferriola, another powerful organized crime figure. It was a gambling case, but it was in the federal building, and that caught on like that wildfire. But I could see then that the stations were saying, "Hey, let's run with this," and so I've been able to do a lot of organized crime stories more than I did before at other stations where I worked.
Interesting. Now going back to the civil disorders of 1968, and then the subsequent trial after that. What was your connection to that? Did you cover that?
When it first happened in '68, I was still at WIND, but I was on the street. And I'll tell you, I'll have to admit, at that period of time, I really was convinced between that and 1969 that we were on the verge of some kind of revolution. In April, we had, of course, the Dr. King riots after King was assassinated in Memphis. We had a lot of turbulence and violence in Chicago. The whole west side of Chicago went up in flames. And then we had the convention riots in August of that year, which, of course, has been world famous during the Battle of Michigan Avenue and so on and so forth. They covered several of those, even though I was not with TV at the time. In fact, I think I was there on a Monday when the rumble started. I followed the group downtown, and they climbed up aboard a statue and tried to take that down and so on and so forth. And that I think that Monday night really triggered the start of a whole week of disturbances. So it was a very time that really stunned people. And that was culminated at the same time that was going on. We had a lot of disturbances at the high school level in Chicago, because at that time, most of the principals in those high schools in the inner city were white. And a lot of the black African-American residents were raising Cain about that. So we had disturbances there. And then the following year, we had the Days of Rage, which is only isolated to Chicago, when the men of what they call the Weather Underground went on a rampage in the fall of that year, running down the Gold Coast. That's where a lot of dough is, on Astor Street, with billy clubs and everything, smashing windows, then took to the streets on Saturday, smashing windows in downtown Chicago and battling with police. They had the helmets on. They were calling billy clubs, things of that nature. So they're looking to be aggressive. And I thought that was the latest chapter in the violence, and you began to wonder, with the Vietnam War going on at that time and the protest, it was a very stormy period, I'll tell you that right now.
Really? Now, did you go out and were you on the streets with, like, for example, during the what's recently been described as the police riot in the park that night, or while
they were... I'll tell you one thing. Yeah, the Wednesday night of that night, I was not out. I was at the station inside, but the other nights I was out there. And I'll tell you one thing. I want to say this. I know a lot of people contend the police overreacted, and they probably did, even though they're paramilitary and disciplined. You can take so much. Remember, this is August, very hot in Chicago. These men were working 12 hours a day. I'm talking about the police officers. Many of the protesters were trying to lose their cool. They were throwing everything at them, and they're actually throwing excrement at some of them with razor blades in it. So there's a lot of stress that they are under. And they did react, some people say overreact, and But to say it was a complete, it's not a one-sided story. The police, I think, in many ways, got bum-wrapped in a degree. I know some of them overreacted, but I think in a way, the conditions that they had, the conditions they're under, and the fact that these people were trying to provoke them to violence, and they succeeded in some cases. But as I indicate, I thought with all those things culminating, I thought these things were coming to an end. I thought the city was going up for grabs.
It seemed like the whole country is going up for grabs.
Yeah, it wasn't isolated here, sure. Of course, the convention. But Chicago had hammered that year with both the King riots and yeah. the convention riots. Now, we had in 67, we had big riots. In 65, in L.A. started the Watts riots. Then we had Detroit and Newark in 67. So a lot of the cities were going up in flames. That was, of course, a lot of that protest was African-Americans and the civil rights area. But, of course, the 68 convention was a different story. That was primarily, of course, white riots. And a lot of those people were radical groups from the weathermen and functions like that. And at the same time, by the way, that's when we had some cases where bomb factories were found and so on and so forth. So we had our share of violence at that time. And last but not least, you had the FALN, which is a Puerto Rican independence group that were bombing places in Chicago. And they remember the authorities seized what was called a bomb factory. And so all of this was going on at that time, and sure, I assure you that that was the big news stories in that period, as you can imagine.
And now, did you develop sources within the police, and were you able to?
Develop? Yeah, well, I would do, and I think what you have to do as far as getting sources of any kind, whether it's law enforcement or anything, do they trust you? In other words, if they tell you something confidentially, are you going to respect that, or not blabber down the air, or blabber to some other people? And I had to be able to get that confidence from the people in law enforcement and others. They felt that I was a square shooter, that they told me something in confidence, I would keep it. And they said as a result of that, I would get, of course, some information and tips on certain things, particularly on organized crime, stories of that nature. Television is a video game. You've got to get pictures of these people. And they would sometimes tell me, hey, this guy hangs out here. You can get him going. He hangs out at this restaurant. Or this guy's going to have a court case tomorrow. You'll be able to get him on the federal building or whatever the case would be. So we scratched. And also they gave you information as to, well, some hits come down, who got hit, who was responsible, of course, without nationally being convicted. But you say what federal authorities or city sources feel that who is responsible. And bear in mind, at that time, when I was working out in Chicago at that period in the 70s and early 80s, you had four major organized crime units. You had the FBI, you had the IRS intelligence units, you had the Cook County Sheriff's Department, and then you had the city police's own intelligence unit, organized crime unit, and they were very effective. You don't have that anymore. The FBI, of course, is putting emphasis now on terrorism and things of that nature. The organized crime unit in Chicago deals with drugs and street gangs and so on and so forth. You don't have the media, that is, law enforcement agencies keeping a look at the outfit as we used to, no question about it. In fact, if I made one point, I remember one guy with the ATF told me one time after they... He said, what you don't realize is that the authorities are cracking down on what we call La Cosa Nostra. In other words, a traditional Italian crime syndicate. But that doesn't mean there's not any organized crime going on with different ethnic groups, whether it's Mexicans, Bahamas, or people from the Bahamas, or Jamaicans, or whatever the case might be, and they're right on that, or Russians or Eastern Europeans.
Yeah, it's just different ethnic groups that are doing the same thing. Now, so you were, as you come up in the medium, if you will, from radio to television, and there you are on the streets of Chicago covering Days of Rage and the Martin Luther King assassination and all that. It was the upheaval at the time. And so you said to yourself, you know, I need to get a different job. Let me go and cover the mob because it seems so much safer.
Yes, that was. That was, first of all, more fascinating. I mean, I mentioned that I had the master's in political science. You said that. And one of the things I was studying was extremist groups, that is the Nazis and the communists. And believe it or not, there is a similarity at that time with organized crime because it's paramilitary like they were. No ruthless discipline, co-option. In other words, they didn't have elections to determine the leaders. So you can find, I'm not saying that the outfit was Bolsheviks or anything like that, but I'm saying their status is how they did things was similar to what totalitarian regimes would do. And they'd brook no interference, things like that. They'd fear reprisals, like, of course, if the Nazis and communists would do if a family, they'd wipe out a family to get to the bottom of it, whatever the case might be. So there was similarity to it. I have to admit, I enjoyed a lot of the organized crime stories. I enjoyed doing. There's no denying that. They were fascinating, and they still are, by the way, particularly in that area. When Chicago, I'll be very frank. At one time, I heard several people in law enforcement agencies nationally tell me that the Chicago organization was the most powerful crime syndicate organization in the country because there's only one family. And, of course, you see the media always in New York talking about these various families. There's five families in New York. Chicago only had one. And at one point, according to law enforcement sources that I heard from Labor Department and various groups, the Chicago organization controlled almost everything west of the Mississippi, Chicago West. And that included Kansas City, was considered a satellite crew, just like Milwaukee was. That the Savellas and company were later on was almost at Chicago's beckoning, up to a degree. They respected the Savellas, but the Savella people still, they wouldn't compete with Chicago.
Yeah, I'd have to.
In fact, Tony Accardo, I'll remember this. I went out one day, I have a story called Syndicate and the Sun, where I traveled around the West Coast covering organized crime out there. Tony Accardo once called the Los Angeles mob, or mafia, as they were called, the Mickey Mouse Mafia. That's how little he thought of those out there.
Yes, that would be Herbie Blitzstein and
well, the Blitzstein was in
Mickey
Vegas.
Cohen.
He was in Vegas, and he got involved with some of the Mickey Mouse Mafia out there, and they ended up killing him, if I remember.
Yes,
right.
He was after Spilotro died, who I think was, if I can use the term, as Chinaman. That's the term that we used. He then himself, Blitzstein, was killed. That's right. Spilotro was killed in '86, and his brother. And then shortly after that, Blitzstein and Chicago, for some unknown reason, I don't, to this day, gave up. At one time, they had primacy in Las Vegas. They were the boss there. But after the Spilotros were killed, it became an open city. And there was rumors, I remember a while, went out there that Buffalo was controlling it, and so on and so forth. Gosh, I don't think there's any one organization that runs the show in Las Vegas anymore at all.
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, and in regards to Kansas City, here's how Nick Savella was. A lot of people don't know this. FBI agent Bill Owsley, who was a case agent on the skim case, the straw man case.
It's a great case.
He found, and it was in the notes that he got out of Tuffy's house. He got all those handwritten notes that Tuffy kept to document where he'd been and what he'd been doing in code. But he found that the Tropicana skim, which was separate from the Stardust skim.
That was Kansas City was a Tropicana place. That's right. Always considered. The Kansas City mob had it. That's right. Joe Augusto and those people.
Right. Nick Savella developed that all on his own. There was no Teamsters involvement, no Teamsters loan involvement.
Why, I didn't know that.
Yeah, nothing.
I didn't know that. Interesting. What he did,
he got Roy Lee Williams to deny a loan to the deal Gustafson and some of the other people that were running the Tropicana. And then Joe Augusto had moved in there and kind of gotten their confidence by then. And of course, he indicated that, well, you know, you let me maneuver a little bit, and I probably have some connections that you'll eventually get that Teamsters loan, and they needed it really bad. So they let Joe move in there, and he started that stream of skim. But Nick Savella was getting, when they took him off, they took off the courier, they took off $80,000, and that was 2 months skim. So they were getting 40 grand a month from the Trop alone, but he was sending about 15 of that up to IUPA in Chicago. And it was a code name for IUPA was 22. And he made sure that Shivola, his nephew, who was a Chicago policeman.
That's Shivola and his son. That's the Chicago police officers, by the way.
They
were. That's right.
Yeah. Nick made sure that Shivola got that money and gave it to IUPA himself. And that was, he didn't have to do that, other than he was paying tribute to the Chicago outfit. So right there tells you that they were a little bit down the pecking order from Chicago. And there's no doubt that Ballesteri up there, Mr. Fancy Pants, and the Milwaukee outfit was definitely under the wing of Chicago. They
Ballesteri was caught on tape saying one time that he could recall that the money that he was getting on the skim, his transfusion every month. That was his transfusion.
Yeah.
He got at that time. He pleaded guilty in that trial. And by the way, that trial, if I bring it up very briefly, it was down at a great time in Kansas City. But I recall that the Kansas City media didn't do much play on that trial when it began, because all the Kansas City players, well, Nick Savella had died before it started, but I think those guys all pretty much, and Acosta was a government witness, I think Kyle Thomas and some of those guys pleaded guilty. And so I don't think they were on trial at all, if I recall.
No, they weren't. They turned Joe Augusto and convicted all of our guys in the first skim trial, which was for the Trop. And then the second one, Straw Man 2, that's when all the Chicago guys had to come down here. And
it was Milwaukee. Also, Cleveland was there.
Milton Rockman.
Milton Rockman was there. Mash Rockman. That's right. It was a big. And I'll tell you the story I heard behind that was that could have been a Chicago story. And the Chicago Strike Force was offered that position, and they didn't take it because they didn't think the case was that strong. And it turned out that was the biggest organized crime case involving Chicago crime syndicate people ever. That's bigger than anything before it, anything afterwards. It had more effect on the outfit than any other trial, because the whole leadership went down the drain. IUPA, Cerrone, La Pietra, Lombardo also was convicted on that. So and Cerrone, I mean, and Spilotro, by the way, was severed. His case, they said, was settled out of court, and he was killed in June of 1986. Had nothing to do with the skimming, but all those guys went down the drain on that. It was a big story down there.
Really, it was. Let me ask you one more question about that, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do, John. We're going to cut this off. I'm going to make this into two, like, 30, 35-minute segments, and the next segment, we're just going to do a little cut off here, and then we'll just start back in again, and sure. let's talk about just about some of the mob cases, your more favorite mob cases, and then end up with what you saw when you were here in Kansas City, because you were here, you were attended that trial, and I think
we came down
kind
on
of eyewitness stuff would be interesting.
We went through the entire thing, but you're right, particularly also when the jury got it, we were there every day till it came in.
I remember
meeting and mingling with those guys. That's right.
Well, folks, we're listening to the famous, well-known, intrepid Chicago reporter, mob reporter, bulldog John Drummond, and we're going to cut this off now and come back with the second episode where we're going to really get into the mob, the outfit in Chicago. I don't want to call him the mob, the outfit in Chicago. And some of his day-to-day experiences with him, because he was out there eating in the same restaurants and drinking in the same bars as some of these guys and rubbing elbows with them every once in a while. They knew what you looked like, didn't they, John?
Yeah, they did. They knew my first
name. They knew your first name.
Well, isn't that kind of the danger of moving from radio to television?
Yeah.
You were at least a little bit anonymous as a radio personality.
Right.
And then they only knew you, I guess, from before, because you were famous for your hands pouring beer.
Pouring beer?
In his in the bio, for he was talking about how when he started in TV, he was pouring beer.
Oh, okay. Anyhow, folks, we'll make my public service announcement, and we'll get out of here. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to buy for only like $7. And you're going to watch that and want more. And Gary, he's got more. He's got an app known as the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can download an app and take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And that will hook you up with the podcast with over 150 free episodes. Go out there and share and subscribe and then binge on some of the great true crime stories from the mouth of the men that did it. And then you're going to want to get his latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
You will read the words from the mouth of the men that did it. Then you're going to want to get the Kindle book, which has hyperlinks to video clips with audio from those original transcriptions. You can read and hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it, courtesy of Gary Jenkins and ganglandwire.com.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, John.
All right.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Bang! I got shot in the head.
Who do you believe ordered the hit on you, Mr. Ito?
Vincent Solano.